It's Wednesday, March 14th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ryan Thomas. On our program this week, he did it, hypothetically. We'll talk about that two-hour special on Fox Sunday night that some are saying was O.J. Simpson confessing to the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. Barack Obama is reportedly in development talks with Netflix for a limited-run series there. What might Obama TV look like? And the New York Times' Overlooked feature, 15 obituaries of women ignored at the time of their deaths, printed retroactively to acknowledge and honor the contributions they made. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time is up today, but let's start with National Geographic's reckoning with race and the way that it has covered people around the globe for decades. Editor-in-chief wrote in the April issue that the publication wanted to focus on race this month, but that it couldn't do that in any authentic or credible way until it really came to grips with its own past. One of the most stunning aspects of this, to me at least, is how it appeared to have come out of nowhere. It wasn't as though somebody pointed a finger at National Geographic and said, hey, come clean on this. You've got this horrible legacy. This was really reflective.
Yeah, I mean, I think they deserve a lot of credit for doing that. And they didn't make excuses. They simply said, here's our record. Here's what happened. They put it in context. They hired a university professor, I believe, from the University of Virginia to take a look at racism in National Geographic and what accounted for it. And there was it was just a very straightforward report about their irresponsibility over the years and how they were trying to change it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the major strengths of this piece is the fact that it comes from being proactive rather than reactive, say responding to a complaint, for example. They realize that to do an issue on the subject of race without accounting for their own history and their own journalism and the problems with that in the past would be inauthentic, and so I commend them for that.
Susan Goldberg, the editor-in-chief, in her letter to readers indicated that the magazine's policies would have even shut her out as a woman and as a Jew from having worked there. Talk a little bit about how the magazine went about doing this and also the commitments that it's making for change in the future.
Well, I mean, they are suggesting that they want to handle these stories more sensitively. They have a more diverse group of reporters that they're hoping to, and freelancers that they're hoping to recruit to do stories, and that's all for the good. I mean, we shouldn't forget, National Geographic has, through its photojournalism at the very least, opened up the world to a lot of people, but this big blind spot that they're finally addressing, I think, is going to make it possible that a new generation of readers and viewers is going to be interested in their content who might have been scared away from or objected to some of the things that they've done in the past.
Yeah, I think they went out of their way to hire journalists of color, reporters and photojournalists of color for this issue. I was looking at some of the things that the historian that they hired to do the background detail on this has been saying on Twitter, and he's full of praise, obviously, for this, but he has said, symbolic change will become material change when they hire more journalists of color and diversify their newsroom on a permanent basis. And I thought it was really interesting. He said, and he says them have reporting on issues that aren't connected to race, so that they're not then siloed as the race reporter, right, for example.
Okay, well, it is also Women's History Month, which makes the timing of the New York Times' new project especially poignant. It's called Overlooked. It's a collection of 15 obituaries written retroactively to honor and respect women who had a especially strong impact on our history, culture, and society, but were overlooked at the time of their deaths, primarily because of gender and, in some cases, race. Among them, some really big names, such as Ida B. Wells, Sylvia Plath, Henrietta Lacks, Ada Lovelace, and Charlotte Bronte. In some cases, like that of Henrietta Lacks, perhaps their legacy has been proven out through time. I don't know that at the time of Henrietta Lacks' death, anybody really knew or understood the impact she would have. But I wonder how someone such as Ada Lovelace, who's the first woman computer programmer, or Charlotte Bronte, the author of Jane Eyre, how they would have escaped the eye of an editor if not for sexism.
Well, it's interesting, and there's a separate piece that they published in addition to the obituaries of the women. They had the obituaries editor, William McDonald, write a piece trying to explain why it might have been that there weren't that many women in the obituaries. And basically, he seemed kind of defensive and basically was saying, well, maybe nobody brought them to our attention, or maybe somebody just didn't think they were interested, or maybe we didn't know how important they were till after they were deceased. It sounded like a bunch of excuse making. On the other hand, what I really applaud is what one person can do to make a project like this happen. A young woman who's the digital editor for the obituary page only joined the Times like last year. She pitches this idea, and within a couple of months, here it is. So kudos to her.
I think there's a few other things that are really interesting and stood out to this about me. First of all, I think we have, just like National Geographic, another instance of a news organization scrutinizing its own past, which I think is very interesting. I like the way that the obits didn't follow sort of the traditional born in 1928 to parent X and parent Y fashion. They allowed for a bit more creativity in writing. And they also opened it up for readers to nominate their own forgotten obits as well. So it's a way for readers to participate in the process. So I thought that was very interesting across the board.
What I really liked about this is that so many times the New York Times tries something innovative and then other media try to catch up or emulate them, regardless of whether they have the staff or the technology
that
or the resources to do it.
That goes back to that snowball trend that we saw maybe about 5-6 years ago.
But this is an example of something that news organizations, large and small, could do. Most legacy newspapers, at least, have decent archives and could go back to find material. And certainly it doesn't take a huge amount of technology or even a large staff to do this kind of reporting. I'd like to see it emulated by more local journalists.
There was another aspect to this that I found interesting, was in addition to finding these notable women who had been left out of the obituaries over time, they had also taken a look at some of the language that was used in the obituaries that were written about women, and how oftentimes the women's own identities were left by the wayside for their husbands, using the example of obituaries that were being written to honor Mrs. John Smith, as opposed to whoever Mrs. John Smith actually was. And in a lot of cases, they didn't know.
Well, I mean, journalism is often referred to as a form of collective memory about how we remember the past. And obituaries are the most literal form of that, not only who we remember, but as you say, how we remember them, the kind of language we use. And I think it's fair to say there are probably some gendered choices made here that are very interesting.
Which creates new ways of thinking about it as we move forward. It's not often that you find counter-programming to Awareness or Recognition Months, but Fox News and Tucker Carlson is doing just that, counter-programming Women's History Month with a series on how hard life is for men in America.
We hear a lot about female empowerment in this country, and of course we're totally for that. We're for empowering all Americans. But for some reason, you almost never hear anything about how men are doing in America. So we took a close look at the numbers, and we found them so shocking that we're devoting the month of March to a special series on men in America. Every Wednesday, starting tomorrow, you'll be stunned by the scope of the crisis. We were. It's a largely ignored disaster, and it is a disaster. It affects every person in America. Hope you'll be also heartened by some of the potential solutions we're looking at.
So again, there is an installment of this series that's running every Wednesday night. Now, I'm not saying that the series itself isn't important. I think the timing of it, though, isn't exactly a good look.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, doing it during Women's History Month seemed like it was a deliberate jab at folks. I watched the first installment, the only one that's been on so far. I guess the second one is tonight. And okay, I don't disagree that there are problems facing American men and boys that need to be looked at with more careful scrutiny. But the guest they had on was a somewhat controversial psychologist. It was a really boring interview. There was nothing to, you know, that in any way to visualize what they were talking about. But I mean, I would say I would give them the benefit of the doubt to try to bring more content. But it's just clear the timing was deliberate.
Yeah, I think there are lots of issues that are important to talk about. So depression, suicide rates,
drug use,
blue collar labor after deindustrialization. All of these things are very worthy issues to talk about and to cover. But you would expect them to be covered with care and thoughtfulness and diligence. And so for that reason, Fox News is the last organization on earth you would want leading the charge on these issues. Tucker Carlson, I don't think he cares really a great deal about the plight of the American male, because the timing of this suggests that this is more of a PR stunt to troll liberals, essentially, rather than anything of substance.
I mean, it seems to me that if the Fox News Channel or Tucker Carlson really wanted to counter-program Women's History Month in some way, well, why not focus on conservative women throughout history who maybe haven't received as much attention through the, quote, mainstream media? That would have fit
Sarah
their model.
Palin could have been, you know, somebody that they could
or Phyllis Schlafly or any number of women you could think of.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you talk about all that. These are important issues. I just kind of wonder why not in February or why not in April or why not some other time. And Ryan, you bring up that idea of the audience and that they are important issues and that, you know, they're trying to troll liberals. At the same time, I think that this is also kind of sort of a dog whistle to that inherent Fox audience that is able to see and hear this reporting and say, like the Trump follower that is saying, hey, they're listening to me. They see that my life is rough too.
Right. And I mean, there are people in that audience whose life is rough. But what Fox's narrative is that that white middle-class men are an endangered species. That doesn't really sort of cut the mustard.
Okay. So speaking of other potentially outrageous TV and speaking of other counter-programming, Sunday night, the first episode of American Idol aired on its new home, ABC. And as you might expect, Fox wanted and needed something good to draw viewers back to its air. So it went with this.
In 2006, O.J. Simpson gave a no-holds-barred interview. For over a decade, the tapes of that infamous interview were lost. Until now.
It's not easy to discuss. This is hypothetical. I remember I grabbed a knife. I do remember that portion. Somebody had to get rid of the bloody clothes. You know, it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
O.J. Simpson, The Lost Confession, Sunday at 8, 7 Central on Fox.
That laugh. The special was 2 hours long, and while I haven't had a chance to see the whole thing yet, I had a lot of questions for the interviewer. Soledad O'Brien helped me out and asked some of them for me.
I received a phone call from an attorney who said that OJ was ready to confess. And actually, I thought it was some kind of a scam and didn't believe him. And I thought this guy's a lunatic. But I took his number and said I'd call him back. And the next day I called him back and he said he was willing to do it. And the only condition that he had was that he didn't want to call the book I Did It. He wanted to put an if in front of it so that he would have deniability with his children. He couldn't face his children and he couldn't tell them that he had done it. And that was the way it was portrayed to me.
He didn't want to have to face his children, but he sat down and did this interview using the word hypothetically over and over and over again.
Well, and, you know, 10 years ago, I guess it was, when Judith Regan, who we were listening to, was trying to publish this in the first place and was going to share this interview, there was such a huge backlash, partly because, you know, the families of the victims were thinking he was going to somehow profit from it and that Judith Regan's book imprint was going to profit from it. I guess 10 years later, with a lot of conversation, they convinced the relatives of the victims and it was okay to use it. But I don't know, other than that, what value this two-hour program has for the current discussion. I just don't get it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to add to the sum of human knowledge. But not only that, I think it's extremely distasteful. And I was trying to pin down why. And there's a headline on one of the articles of our Links blog that I think captures it. It's the Vanity Fair piece that says, "Was Fox's American Idol counter genius or gross?" And why that bothers me is I think that we've become so dissociated from events and it's become such a part of popular culture that we have lost sight of the fact that we're talking about the murder of two people. That is astonishing to me. And so this just seems, it seems tawdry and exploitative and really treating a horrible event as tabloid gossip, and I don't like it.
I don't dispute that there's still interest in and maybe even lessons to learn from the O.J. Simpson murder case, but It was, we've had journalism that's been far more subtle and in-depth about this. If you think about O.J. Made in America, the documentary series, for example.
At least it was on ESPN about a year ago.
Yeah, at least it raised some interesting questions about the continuing divide in perceptions about law enforcement that this case, you know, brought up. And that kind of television is worth watching. This just seemed to be there to exploit. And I'm a little bit surprised that Soledad O'Brien, who left CNN after a dispute about their unwillingness to do serious long-form reporting, who started up her own company to do that, just that kind of serious journalism, is fronting this piece. I mean, she deserves to make a living, but I just wondered why she was associated with it.
So as we talk about counter-programming, it begs the question I have to ask, because, Mike, I know no bigger American Idol fan than you. Was it enough to pull you away from American Idol and bring you back to Fox to watch this?
Like this will be the most shocking revelation about me on this show in a
you
long
didn't
time.
Watch it?
I no longer watch American Idol. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I've switched over to The Voice. Okay. But it was brilliant counter-programming on their part to try to run that at the time when American Idol was launching on ABC.
It was brilliant, but as somebody who watches way too much TV to begin with, I didn't know that this was actually going, that this was happening. It wasn't until I was working on the show and Travis McMillan, who's our director, said, "Wait, aren't you talking about OJ?" And I'm like, "Huh?" And I Googled and saw OJ. How did I miss this? Was it all that well publicized? Did people even know that it was going to be on? Did you know about this before I mentioned that it was on?
I did not.
No. Nope. But I don't watch Fox television, not Fox News Channel, Fox television, enough to have seen the promos.
At the same time, Sunday nights for Fox television, that's The Simpsons, that's Family Guy, that's Bob's Burgers. That's kind of the big night that has always been Fox's flagship night. Well, it was, what, about 6 weeks ago or so that this was must-see streaming?
If we see cruelty, if we see inequalities, if we see injustice, why is that? Am I a part of this? Am I willing to do something about it? Are there sacrifices I'm willing to make to change it? And that's not always easy, but it's necessary. That's how progress is made. And that's why I always say that the way America has become more perfect, not perfect, but more perfect, typically has to do with ordinary people deciding, you know what, that's not right.
Right. This is another cliche that I'm fond of invoking, which is nothing right in the world ever occurs without a fight.
Or at least some discomfort.
So that clip was from my next guest needs no introduction, David Letterman's new show. And obviously, his first guest was former President Barack Obama. Well, according to published reports, we'll be seeing a lot more of Obama, or at least his work, on Netflix. Obama TV, you know, we talked about it a little bit towards the end of the presidency. What was he going to do next? This looks like it could be a real thing.
Well, what's really interesting is that former presidents typically live a quiet life out of the political spotlight and out of the rough and tumble of politics. I mean, Jimmy Carter, for example, doing Habitat for Humanity, all very worthy things. What's really interesting is that this may signal, I mean, it'll depend on the type of program that comes out of this, but it may signal his willingness to still be part of the national conversation and to contribute to that conversation by spotlighting issues that are close to him.
It makes sense both for him and for Netflix, obviously. I mean, they're trying to build up their stable of original content with highly sellable individuals fronting it. David Letterman, frankly, I've watched that first installment with President Obama, and aside from that interview, I don't really know that it was all that interesting a vehicle, and David Letterman is not really known for being, you know, a high profile interviewer, but to have the president or the first lady come on, and we don't know what they're going to do yet, right? Are they going to
there's some speculation.
Are they going to interview people? Are they going to talk about topics that are close to their heart? Are they going to put their name onto documentaries and other kinds of programs that support their idea? We don't know yet, so it's hard to say what the impact will be, but I think both sides are going to win from that.
Yeah, all we know is that they're going to focus on inspirational stories, and then people are speculating that that's about issues that are close to the president, like climate change or voting rights, for example. But it's, you know, let's put a big TBD next to it.
I mean, the other thing is that Netflix not only has a big American audience, but they have a huge audience internationally. So here's another vehicle for the former president to get his message out there.
Okay, well, life moves fast. so fast. I can't believe it was just this weekend that all anyone was talking about was Stormy Daniels and the interview that she gave to Anderson Cooper. It doesn't have a run date yet, and there's a question as to whether it ever will run. Saw something early this morning that now CBS is saying it isn't about the legality of the interview in running it, but they still have a lot more reporting to do before they can even put a run date on it.
Well, yeah, because I think that's a good point. I think there was the legal issue, and then there's the ethics issue in terms of the public interest aspect of this. And typically, we would say, we've said on this show, the private lives of politicians are private. I think one of the things that has come up as something that could sustain a public interest argument is the use of campaign money to as hush money, essentially, for Stormy Daniels. And that would then strengthen the public interest component to this, because essentially you have the silencing of a voice in order to influence electoral politics. So that may be what they're looking into.
I do agree they should do more reporting. I do agree that there could be a public interest component to this otherwise salacious story. But if CBS wants to use that interview, they better do it before we move on to the next big thing. And unfortunately, that happens rather quickly these
days.
Well,
and if you think about it, that was what, like Saturday, Sunday, everybody was talking about that. Frankly, as I look at our script and as we're having this conversation, the world has moved on to Rex Tillerson by now. And by the time this show, where we record every Wednesday afternoon, by the time it airs Wednesday evening, we could be on to the new chaos scandal of the day, and it could be forgotten about.
It is interesting to me, though, that I think news organizations are all too willing to play along with the narrative about Stormy Daniels and how she just doesn't want to give her money back. And if the president will take her back the money, then she can be free to say whatever she wants to say. She's not an innocent in all of this. I mean, she's a very smart woman who is making a lot of money off of this newfound publicity. And she and her attorneys are borrowing a playbook from the president, frankly, in the way they're using the media and using social media to keep her name in the news.
Okay. Well, ironically enough, is we're here discussing what we have a right to know about the president's past and extramarital affairs. We're in the midst of Sunshine Week. It's a week devoted to freedom of information and government attempts to squash it. There have been editorials and papers across the country, including some that you can read on our links blog at kbia.org. And those are all calling for transparency among government entities and offering promises to readers to keep on those government leaders and keep them honest. One of those columns and opinion pieces actually came from right here in town from the Columbia Daily Tribune, kind of outlining a very specific story that reporters there have been trying to get access to information and that the Columbia Police Department and City of Columbia is making really hard for them to do.
Yeah, well, on the general point about the editorials, I love that these editorials are explaining the sort of the necessity of journalism, talking about the value of transparency. I think at a time of a crisis in media literacy and a crisis of public trust in journalism, the more journalists and organizations can do to demystify these things, I think, is a good thing. Locally, I think, again, we have a newspaper engaging its audience with an explanation of, here's this issue about this local former basketball player who is alleged, I think, to have committed sexual harassment and sexual assault. The Title IX complaint was leveled against him. But that's the extent of their knowledge. We don't know what the follow-up was, what the timeline was, what the involvement of the police department was. And they explain to their audience, essentially, this is the story, you know, this is what we know, and this is what we need to know, and here are the roadblocks we're encountering.
I would say that I agree that it's good for the media to tell the public every once in a while why transparency and access to records is important. But in the context of the conversation we've been having for more than a year now about journalists focusing too much on themselves, I think I'd much rather see an example of the value of sunshine that this Columbia Daily Tribune story points to than have a lot of editorials with our thumping our chests about it. And I will say, we've talked about the Tribune in a negative way past several weeks. This is really good effort on their part to insist on getting these incident reports from the police department. When the police department gives them one excuse, they come back with another argument. At least they're forcing the city to try to justify what they're doing. And it doesn't sound to me like the moving target of explanations they're giving is very convincing.
So it's good to see that the Tribune is doing this, and hopefully they'll continue to and keep us updated on that process. Before we go, I can't believe that we are about to do this again. That's right, because it wouldn't be a week on Views of the News if we didn't bring up some move by Sinclair Broadcast Group Management that makes us want to pull our hair out. Ryan, I already had my eye on this one when you sent me a link to it over the weekend. Go ahead, tell our audience what it is they're doing now.
Well, they are directing their on-air talent to read essentially a hostage script about how biased and awful their colleagues within the journalism profession are. And I think that this is just dreadful. It's one thing for journalists to call out and correct other journalists when there are errors and inaccuracies. We would encourage that, absolutely. It's another thing altogether to buy into spurious and unsupported accusations of partisan bias, which, by the way, no social science supports that view, that there's partisan bias in journalism. So, you know, it troubles me because it's an erosion of journalistic autonomy. It's a directive that's come from corporate. And I'm afraid I do think that it shows a lack of integrity for any journalist that goes along with this.
And this message isn't just a tagline, you know. Oh, no. This isn't democracy dies in the dark. This isn't all the news that's fit to print. This is something much more, it's deeper than that.
It's like a 60 to 75 second piece. It's a script, and every local market, they have to read the exact same script, filling in their call letters or their branding or whatever. And I agree. I mean, it's kind of like a hostage script, or one person quoted in the story said it was like a POW making a recording, right? Because it's a good thing, I think, for local television news to have more commentary, opinion that's local. But this isn't local. It's being dictated by the corporation.
Yeah. And the ironic thing is that that Sinclair is known for the pushing of conservative commentary. But it's often about issues of sort of national security and terrorism. If we had local commentary on local issues, fine, go ahead, but it's so, and then that means that you've lost space in your newscast for the coverage of local issues. It is a baffling thing.
And to show you how much they manage this whole thing, they not only instruct them on exactly what to say, but what to wear and what not to wear. So you're not supposed to wear red, blue, and purple because that might be seen as partisan or political, and you want to look apolitical or neutral when you're doing this. So wear jewel tones, I think was the instruction that they gave them. So they're managing this down to a fare thee well, and they're even saying, if you have a comment about this, don't send your comments to our local station, send them to corporate and we'll respond.
Yeah. Meaning if the employees have the comment, or if
no, I mean if viewers have a comment, they're not supposed to share it and have let the local station engage with their own audience. The audience is supposed to submit their comments to corporate, and corporate will respond
because that's going to also help create that sense of community in local news coverage.
Right.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for this week. I would like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. We appreciate your time. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about. That's on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. I'd like to take a second to thank RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Aaron Hay for handling the audio, making sure we sound good. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.